And the deficit is equal to the expenditure minus income, right, or expenditure minus taxes, revenue. So the government can, if you want a deficit of 100 billion, the government can do it in two ways, two polar opposites, two polar methods of doing it. Either spend $100 billion more or take in $100 billion less. Okay? In other words, if the budget is, if now expenditures are 600 billion, let's say, and tax revenue is 600 billion, if you want a $100 billion deficit, you can either increase this to 700, or you can cut this to 500. This brings a political element to the picture. Left-wing Canadians tend to always be in favor of increasing government expenditure anyway. So they do it now on a cover of helping the economy, increasing spending, lifting the thing up to the full employment line. So left-wing Keynesians will opt for, let's take a little grid here. Keynesians, liberals, conservatives. Okay, so during depressions, liberals may favor increasing government spending. Conservatives will tend to be in favor of tax cuts. So you're leaving more money to the people and so forth and so on. So cut taxes. During inflationary periods, you can either do, if you want a surplus of 100 billion or now, of course, a lesser deficit, you're up here now. 600. If you want a surplus of 100 billion, you can either increase taxes to 700 billion, have a surplus, or you can cut expenditures to 500 billion. So, conservatives tend to favor cutting expenditures during inflation. And liberals, of course, are favor tax increases, as they are anyway. So, if you had really heroic, extreme free market, or whatever you want to call it, Keynesians, and they were in power, they would then cut tax. During depressions, they would cut taxes very heavily, and then during inflation, they cut spending very heavily, and that, you get down eventually to sort of a zero budget, okay? Sort of by accident. This, of course, never happens. There are no conservative Keynesians who hold this view. Liberal Keynesians tend to sort of ride, you know, tend to sort of be dominant, so you have spending going up in the depression, matched by taxes going up in inflation, which means that government spending is always going up relative to the private sector, not by accident. So, in the course of what you have is, you have conservatives, you have liberals, you have moderates. The moderates are in fact a little mix of both. You cut a little, increase a little spending, cut a little taxes, or whatever. Nobody ever cuts government spending, ever. I mean, it hasn't been done in America, it hasn't been done since the first 2 years of the Eisenhower administration. Ever since then, nobody even talks in terms of cutting government spending. Reagan, when he talked about government cutting government spending, what he really meant was cutting the rate of growth of government spending, okay? A very different concept. So this is out. This is now verboten, unthinkable. Okay. So now we have, now the question is, how do you maneuver if you have a depression? So they're moderates. You do a little mix of both. So the conservatives are people who, conservative Keynes are people who want to have a little bit more of a tax cut compared to a little bit more of a spending increase. And you have a general mishmash, Keynesian mishmash somewhere in the middle. Okay, this was a picture until the mid-1970s where something cataclysmic happened to the Keynesian movement. Namely, remember the old picture, you have a business cycle of inflation and depression. If there's a depression, you pump in spending. If there's inflation, you get spending. What do you do if you have both at the same time? What do if you have inflation and a depression at the same time? Now called stagflation, inflationary recession. This appeared for the first time. Well, it appeared in the 30s, but nobody recognized it, because we're in a big depression anyway. There was a big inflation within it. But the first time it appeared in this current phenomenon was a very small amount. I believe the depression of 1957-58. And it was a big depression, there was a big unemployment, separate bankruptcies, and prices, instead of going, which had always gone down in all previous depressions, and creeped up a little bit. Didn't go up a lot, like 74, 75, but they crept up. It's very unusual, that's supposed to happen. And I remember one of my favorite anecdotes about this is I studied under Arthur Burns, Columbia. Burns is a conservative Keynesian, a moderate conservative Keynesian, as I described. He went to Washington to be head of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Eisenhower administration. He later returned under Ford and Nixon to be the most inflationary Federal Reserve person in history, I think. Talking, constantly attacking inflation all the time he was there. thereby establishing a sound money reputation. Anyway, he comes back after 4 years, Eisenhower administration, he gives a Keynesian lecture about what to do, and the same stuff I've been telling you here, except without the attack on it. And so I asked him a question. I said, well, Professor Burns, there's now a situation where there's unemployment, depression, recession, and yet prices are going up. What do we do about that? He said, well, it's not going to last long. 3 months will be over and all that, which was true. I said, okay, but what happens if, supposing sometime in the future this happens again? We have even more so. We have a big recession, et cetera, and prices are going up even faster. And he stopped for a while. If you ever heard him speak, he speaks like W.C. Fields without the humor. And he said, well, in that case, we'll all have to resign. Now, it happened in 73, 75, it happened in 79, 81. Of course, nobody ever resigns. I mean, he didn't resign, nobody else resigned. And that's one of my laws. I have a bunch of sociological laws, Rothbard's laws, one of which is nobody ever resigns. And once in a while, of course, the law is broken, but it's not very often. This is increasingly true. And we now have a situation in 73, 75, we have a big recession and prices were going up by 14% a year or so. And what do you do? Well, Keynesians are a big trouble. What can you say about that? They don't resign. They don't stop being Keynesian. They become very low-key about being Keynesian. They're very confused. And so what you do is, if you have a situation where you're supposed to put on the accelerator and the depression and take off and put on a brake and a boom, you have both at the same time, you do both rapidly alternating and hope that something works. And close your eyes when something works. Right? So the result is the Keynesians are in a total state of confusion, and they don't know what to do at this point. At this point, we have a big deficit that's supposed to be inflationary. On the other hand, we just had a recession. Should we do that? On the other hand, we have inflation. We don't want to heat that up. Total chaos, intellectual chaos. I really should stop talking at this point, but that's really, I haven't explained inflation or recession yet. Now I'll do that in a minute if my throat clears up. Anybody have any comments on this? Any questions, comments? Any converted Keynesians that come out and confess?
I thought James Watts said there weren't any Democrats and Republicans. They were just liberals and
Americans.
Do you think he's going to resign, James Watts?
Okay. I have no idea.
Did he get the shot in the foot award?
My pardon?
The shot in the foot
award. I think it was very funny. It was hilarious.
I read this article, and in fact, there was a picture of Secretary Schultz going, did he really say that? Beside the Army General that said, we're sending in more troops into Vietnam. Lebanon. Yeah. But there's something about James Watt, and he said, yes, in my administration, we have equal opportunity employment. We got a few Italians, we got a few Jews, a few cripples.
that was Butts, wasn't it?
It was Watt.
Yeah.
He was a Jewish guy who had a paralyzed left.
Butts was the one.
Maybe we're looking for a Jew with a paralyzed arm.
Enough to eat a warm place. Butts was a warm place to sleep, enough to eat.
The way he said it, my wife saw him on television. I was teaching that day when Watts said it. The way he said it was very funny. He was speaking before some Chamber of Commerce or something. He said, we have this new commission on coal leasing, some of the nonsense. He said, it's very balanced. We got 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. We have 1 black, 1 woman, 2 Jews, and a cripple. Cutting them off. I thought it was hilarious. So, yeah.
Are you going to be talking about the banks and the liquidity crisis and that sort of thing?
Oh, the
debt crisis.
Oh, God. So when will we going to stop?
I don't think there's time for me. I got actually one little question. You know how a bank can keep a certain amount of its cash and reserve and loan the rest out? And by doing clever bookkeeping, it manages to multiply the money by the factor of whatever it wants. And so, 20% reserve, it multiplies it by 5.
Right.
Shouldn't that, that cost a 500% increase in money supply?
Right.
How come it doesn't cause runaway inflation?
Well, it causes inflation. It's a question of how much is done. It hasn't been done enough to run away yet, except in cases where there have been runaway inflation. Germany and Hungary and so forth and so on.
Right.
There are, it's, we stop when?
I think, actually, just about any topic could take all night.
Yeah, for 47. Right.
If you can answer generally some questions and then refer them to reading materials.
Yeah. My new book, The Mystery of Banking, solves the whole banking question. Explains it. Actually, it's the first one that really explains it. What happens is money and banking textbooks will explain it, except they have to have the wrong point of view on it. My own little pamphlet, most hard money people have the right point of view, they don't explain it in detail. I do a combined explaining in detail with hard money analysis. Basically, it's the it functions something like warehouse receipts. Okay. And warehouse receipts.
Is this the book?
Yeah, that's right.
No, that's what it's
called. That's the old book. The new book is called The Mystery of Banking. It's a hardcover book.
It's not here today, eh?
No. It just came out about a week ago.
Who gives a
gift? I'm using it in my class. It hasn't come to the class yet. I have my desk copy, but it hasn't come to the class yet. Bookstore. Any day. So, but basically what happened, like warehouses, the warehouse law has been an undeveloped state until fairly recently. For some obscure reason. Like the common law, statute law of warehousing was mixed up. For example, until 10 years ago, the Chicago grain elevators, which are the grain warehouses for wheat and so forth, people deposit grain in the warehouses and leave it for a while and so forth and so on and pick it out. And the grain warehouses began to speculate in the depositors, the customers' wheat. It's very much as if you're depositing something in a warehouse and somebody takes it out and lends it out, expecting you won't pick it up for a while. And they were doing this systematically. They were making money on the other guys. They were charging the wheat people money for depositing, and then they'd take it out and lend it out. And it was not illegal. They found it was maybe illegal. It's called embezzlement, which I think it is. And then it became a no-no, and that was the end of that. However, in the case of banks, which are originally money warehouses, where people put gold on deposit, and left it there, so the banks began to do the same thing. And a case came up early 19th century England, a classic case about if you deposit something, is it a debt or is it a bailment? Bailment being a legal term for, for example, if I leave something in something, a safety deposit box would be a bailment. I leave it there, it's supposed to be there, damn it. If it's not there, I come for it, somebody has to pay, somebody's a crook. So is a bank deposit a bailment or is it a loan? And he was arguing back and forth. The judge unfortunately ruled it was a loan. Although he admitted, this is truly a legal situation ever since, so it's a peculiar kind of loan because you have to sort of keep it on hand and and you're not really paying the guy and he thinks it's there all the time. So it's a very confused decision of the judge. And ever since then, fractional reserve banking has been legal. Where you can issue warehouse receipts to non-existent money, non-existent gold, and lend them out, and hope that you won't get caught, with hope that people won't call for redemption, in which case you go back. You don't go to jail, you only go bankrupt. So that was a key legal difference.
Did it happen before then, with the creation of the Bank of England?
Well, the Bank of England did it on a massive scale, but there weren't that many other banks before that.
It was the Bank of England that started it.
That's right.
So it was before that decision.
The decision came much later. For some reason, nobody really didn't go to the courts until 1915 or something. I don't know why. I don't know why they didn't take it to the courts.
Probably because there were no bankruptcies. if there weren't bankruptcies, why would anyone complain?
Well, the Bank of England went bankrupt at the very beginning. Bank of England went bankrupt about 2 years after they got started. The government then stepped in and said, you can suspend specie payments. You don't have to pay your debt or your... you can continue, and you can enforce the debts on your debts and other and your debtors, but you don't have to pay the debt. They did this several times systematically every time the Bank of England got in the hock. So finally they confirmed monopoly in the Bank of England. Only the Bank of England issued banknotes within a 50-mile radius of London and stuff like that. Anyway, the thing is that fractional reserve banking doesn't last very long if it's a free banking system. If you have a real free market banking, you can't do very much, even with this legal problem. Because say I set up a Rothbard bank, okay, and I start issuing fake warehouse receipts, why not, okay, and lend them out, who will buy them? One thing. Also, if I have a couple of clients, and I lend them this money, these Rothbard dollar notes or something, the deal in gold, pretty soon my borrower is going to spend his money on something else. He'll give the notes to somebody else to buy something with, and the other guy's not going to be a Rothbard bank client. He'll be a client of some other bank. The other bank calls upon me for redemption. I ain't get the money. I go bankrupt. This check, this free market check on fractional reserve banking is pretty powerful. So the fractional reserve banking never really got started in a real inflationary manner until the central bank comes in, Bank of England, Federal Reserve Bank, Bank of France, etc., and props up the whole system. It's like a government cartel, it's like a compulsory cartel. It is a compulsory cartel. Allowing the banks to inflate uniformly so no one bank gets into trouble. And so anyway, the racketeering part of this is that the Federal Reserve System, for example, was sold to the United States on the basis of checking the excessive tendency of private banks to inflate. Actually, the reason is just the opposite. The private banks who couldn't inflate got together and got the government to pass this law so the Federal Reserve Bank could engage in a cartelized inflation. The exact opposite of this. It's just like antitrust law. The same sort of stuff all over again. And the Fed, the Federal Reserve in the United States, the Bank of Canada here, whatever, essentially prints money in different sophisticated ways. And actually, plain simple fact, prints the money, and this is, and then the whole money supply pyramids upward. And they're still doing it, despite all the talk about checking inflation and that sort of stuff.
But in fact, that business about banks going bankrupt, there was one in Britain that printed a lot of money and went under. And the other banks bailed it out because they wanted to keep... When
well, once in a while, I mean, the United States too, like, they were really crooked banks.
Yeah.
I mean, they just walk off the assets, okay? Or they lend money, very unsound loans, they lend money to people who go bankrupt, something like that. They can go under, and they're bailed out by the Federal Reserve or the Federal Deposit Insurance and all that, but it's very isolated. And what I'm talking about is a real bank run, where everybody says, in other words, I'd be interested in this sort of thing. People, I was talking to Paul the other day about private action, sort of like agoric action. One agoric action I'd like to see is a mass run on the banks. Everybody cashes in. Okay, we don't like banks anymore. We insist on cash. This would cause a lot of headaches. They could get around it, but there are a lot of original turmoil. They have to adjust. I mean, the Federal Reserve and the last analysis would just print the money and give it to the banks. But there'd be a lot of institutional problems. They have to act fast. And they have a lot of, you know, they have a lot of headaches.
What they do in cases like that, though, is... declare a bank holiday
one way.
But they simply, the government simply locks the doors on that bank and won't allow people to take money.
Partially
what happened with the trust company, with Rosenberg's. When the depositor wanted their money, the government just said, I'm sorry, you can't get it for X amount of time. In fact, certain people who wanted to get their money out were not allowed to do it at all because they had been associates of the previous owners.
So it's like suspension of species.
Yeah, I mean, this
clear a bank holiday. Right?
The banks are legalized thieves, just as government is a legalized thief. And government simply comes in and says, "I'm sorry, you can't take your money back from the thief."
There's also an interesting law which was passed during 1932, the last free banking, before the Federal Deposit Insurance came in, so it locked the whole thing up. A lot of bank failures, runs on banks. The Republican administration, first of all, they blamed it on the communists. Because the commies are out there, or the Bolsheviks in those days, they're undermining the soundness of the banking system. They're injecting fear and suspicion in the hearts of the public and the banks. They didn't need communists to inject fear and suspicion. The banks were collapsing all over the place. And second of all, they said that they passed a law making it illegal to spread rumors that a bank is unsound or bankrupt. Yeah, exactly. It's on the books.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they like them apples. So,
the Canadian government did something similar. Trudeau passed an order when there was a cartel about the uranium price.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cartels are illegal in Canada. Mm-hmm. So, Trudeau passed an order in council making it illegal to talk about the illegal activities of the Canadian government.
Are you kidding?
Wow, seriously? There was an order in council, it was about 1977. He passed an order in council which makes it illegal for any Canadian to talk about the uranium cartel, which was illegal that the Uranium Cabinet put itself
into. Is that still in existence? Was that
I don't know if that's still in existence.
No. No. So, tell me what
lies.
That's right. Turn that man in. He's illegal.
Well, I'm not going to sit in the same room as a young criminal. Stalling slime.
Or is the standard conservative doctrine is if it's on the books, you got to enforce it. You might not like the law, but you have to enforce it to the hilt if it's on the books, right? There's a send that man to jail.
Protect the public.
Nice way. So,
I mean, what would we think if what would we have if all these people went around talking about the fact that the government didn't do things right? I mean,
this guy's obviously in Washington.
I'm kidding. I mean, it's, I mean, undermining the confidence in the Canadian government. Right,
exactly. I should wind up. I mean, this is like in 2 minutes to sum up a whole bunch of literature of what the Austrian business cycle theory is and what the explanation of all this inflationary recession is. That's 1 minute. Statement. You can read it in my America's Great Depression or in Hayek's monetary theory and trade cycle of human action. Basically, it is. This is what one of the things wrong with the Friedmanites. The Friedmanites say yes, banking, excessive banking expansion, money supply causes inflation. They don't see any other problems with inflation. It's only the prices go up and down, and people can't calculate as well. Actually, what happens with inflation through the banking system is that messes up the whole production structure. Interest rates are distorted, production is distorted, and what you have is an excessive investment in capital goods and what's being called higher orders of production, machine tools, construction, cement, things like that, and not enough of an investment in consumer goods. You have a distortion of this production structure. Usually, there's a lattice work, everything clears and clicks and so forth, because the government inflates, lends money, and the banks inflate at the behest of the government, lend money to businessmen. Businessmen then expand unnecessarily as if there are a lot of savings to invest, and there really isn't. This causes this distortion, this overinvestment of capital goods. And as soon as the inflation stops, as soon as the monetary inflation stops, this is revealed by a process I can't go into, I just have to sum that up, stated, finally. As soon as you stop pumping in more money, these construction companies, capital goods industries, start making severe losses. Their overexpansion is now revealed. The recession then becomes necessary and healthy in order to wash out these malinvestments, to liquidate these unsound investments, and get back to the proper proportion. So the resources are shifted back to consumer goods, unless the excess amount of investment goods are eliminated. So recession then becomes the inevitable, unfortunate, but necessary and inevitable consequence of the boom, and a healthy consequence of the boom, the boom. Boom is the problem, recession is the correction. This is, of course, totally opposed to the Keynesian doctrine, which you have to, and Friedmanite doctrine, you have to pump and do something to correct recession. So so this means that the Austrian policy conclusion derived from that is if there's an inflation, stop inflating, there will be a recession. Think about recession, and let the recession do its healthy work fast and get it over with so we can have the recovery. Let these resources shift back to the proper free market level. The more you try to hold up the recession and delay it, the more you try to interfere with it, keep wage rates up, bail out unsound companies and so forth, the more you're prolonging the recession and converting it into a chronic depression, the more you're delaying the recovery. So the choice then becomes, after the inflation boom, the choice becomes a quick, sharp, sort of surgical cut, and the recovery is on, or a chronic depression continues on and on. And what happened in the 1930s is Herbert Hoover, far from being a great apostle of laissez-faire, was the first big New Dealer. He was the same, his policy was the same as Roosevelt, except less lower degree. So as soon as the recession hit, the stock market crash hit, he immediately intervened with all the New Deal legislation, bailing out bankrupt firms, keeping wage rates up, keeping prices up, et cetera, pumping in more credit, lowering interest rates, the whole business, public works projects. What this did was delay the recession, prolong it, and Roosevelt, of course, intensified it. So you have a 11-year depression. So something which would have been like a 9-month recession is converted to a chronic, seemingly permanent depression. And a capitalism, a free market, gets the blame for it. Instead of the government intervention which creates it, it's the free market which is, of course, it's levying the blame, and those conservatives still keep maintaining, despite all the evidence, that Hoover is a great laissez-faire person, of course, of digging their own grave on this, because they're holding up somebody that everybody else thinks prolonged the depression, and they were right. So anyway, it's
the difference between recession and depression is simply how long it lasts.
Yeah, it's how long, how intense it is. It's big, It's a depression, sort of more mild to recession. Actually, the word depression has now been outlawed by economists. They don't use it, but it's too depressing. The old days, see, these people didn't talk about depression. They talk about mild depression and severe depression. And then depression stopped being used as a bad PR. So now it's recession. Big recession. You know, it's all semantics. Correct, yeah. Sometimes, back in the 60s, they started talking about, they started saying, maybe there are no recessions anymore either. Maybe they're just sideways corrections or whatever. That was too euphemistic.
That technical correction.
Well, this
that's it.
Should we have a general evaluation by people about what they thought of science?
Yeah.